Want to stay up to date on the biggest stories in pop culture and entertainment? Then be sure to check out the TMZ podcast. I'm Charlie Cotton from TMZ, the TV show, and every day I'll sit down with a member of our news team to give exclusive breakdowns of the day's most talked about headlines, stories we break, and the stories you care about. So check out the TMZ podcast, Monday through Friday, and the other podcasts from the TMZ audio network like Last Days and TMZ Verified, available on all podcast platforms.
Let's just say I like to live life on the edge.
And to give my small business the same edge, I turned to IHG Hotels and Resorts. Just signing up for IHG Business Edge gave everyone at my company a chance at saving at over 5,800 hotels worldwide. And my registered travelers receive Silver Elite status after just one stay. So either way, I keep my edge. Sign up now at businessedge.ihg.com. Terms apply.
Welcome to a bonus episode of There Will Be Dungeons. We do these on the monthly, and we do it for you, the fine supporters out there listening. Everyone else gets it, but they get it way late. You guys get the cutting edge version of the file, and we thank you from the bottom of our hearts for being supporters and for letting us do this. Let's not waste any time, because we just finished a major arc, an entire season and run of the Delvers, and that's a big deal. So I know we have a lot of questions. Let's throw it to Kristen. Kristen, let's get going.
All right, first one is more of a, I hope you guys know this fact, because this has come up quite a bit. Hey guys, thank you for the amazing run with the Guild. Your show is the highlight of my week. Now to my question. Did you know there is a real snake island? It's off the coast of Brazil, and no one is allowed to visit because there are so many venomous snakes.
Whoa.
Mind blown.
Is that true? That's crazy.
Yeah, it actually exists, and it's, you'd have to look up the number of snakes per square mile. It's obscene.
So the actual name is Ilha de Queimada Grande. Pretty sure I nailed that. Also known as Snake Island, island off the coast of Brazil, Atlantic Ocean, administered part of the municipality of the state of Sao Paulo. The island's small, only 43 hectares or 106 acres, and has a temperate climate. I'm trying to find the part about... Oh, here we go. The island was the only home of the critically endangered venomous Balthrops insurulus, which is a golden lancehead pit viper.
Yeah, some people pay good money for that.
Yeah, they do. And they only eat birds, so...
Oh, that was my question, is what they ate. But hey, if birds visit, then...
Yeah, then it's lunch for everybody when the birds visit.
Works out.
I guess apparently there were some rising sea level issues that were adding more pressure to their population, but they're still down there. But anyway, yeah, it's full of venomous snakes, although it looks like that's the main snake. The island is also home to a smaller population of Dispus albifrons, a non-venomous snake species that coexists with the bad ones. So there's about 4,000 of those snakes. So what I'm saying is I'm never going to Snake Island, is what I'm saying.
It says here the population is 430,000 snakes.
Oh, that's more than I thought.
It's a lot of snakes.
Oh, the golden lanceheads, there's only 4,000. So that's the one that's having trouble. But yeah, 430,000 otherwise of the other snakes there. And that's insane. That's too many snakes. Also, how'd they get there? What's going on with this island? Did it split off from Pangaea and a little chunk went out there and they're like, oh no, we were on this part when it fell off and we can't go anywhere. That's probably what happened. I'm going with that.
They were having a snake convention when Pangaea split.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the way I look at Kyle's version of Snake Island was, it was such a fun MacGuffin, not MacGuffin, because it's not really a MacGuffin, but this idea that we went to a place that we didn't actually go to in real time, and then it kept rearing its head, and then, you know, we'd have memories from it. And I thought that was a really great arc, Kyle. Are you proud of your Snake Island, the way you implemented it, instead of it just being just a place to go? Instead, you made it like a place in our heads, kind of.
Oh, heck yeah. Like that and the montage episodes, I think, did a lot to fill out the Delvers and make that time we spent, because we spent, you know, 10 months playing consistently, which is a lot of time in D&D.
Right.
But my personal favorite part of so many stories is the day-to-day job, like Ghostbusters. It's great that you have a movie, but I'd almost rather just watch them do the daily stuff. That's why Loki frustrated me so much. I just want to see him, like, work. Just go out and just do normal missions. It went straight to the campaign. And I just love that aspect of the working Joe busting ghosts.
Yeah.
So Snake Island eventually was going to become this whole, like, Indiana Jones, like, big thing, but it was just way more fun to constantly add to it with time.
I think that
it was, yeah, it was built up so much too that once you reach a certain critical mass of building something up, you can never go there because it will never live up to expectations. So that's kind of how you do that, where it's everything you could anybody could possibly imagine it to be. But because you never go there, it maintains that. So it can still be just as awesome.
Yeah, I think it was a really brilliant move. The way you implemented it, and there's still mysteries about it that make me intrigued. Like, there was world building there, and that's my favorite kind of storytelling. So I guess good job, Kyle, on that.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
All right, on to the next question. How did Paylor feel about Splendor Belt casting guidance on himself before making a religion check to get down from the ledge in the Goggles Granny episode? Wouldn't he have technically asked Paylor to guide him in asking Paylor for guidance?
I mean, technically, yes, but I don't know.
If it gives you a bonus, right?
Yeah, but there's two things going on here. One is me being a little loosey-goose with abilities in the moment and not, you know, and not really applying it to the broader lore of what a cleric might typically do or might typically ask of Paylor if that was their chosen deity. Instead, he's a little bit in the moment of like, you know, well, this worked last time. I touched myself again and works. Like, he's not thinking that far ahead. He's not been in particularly very pious, which is, again, a little hilarious that he's a cleric, perhaps the most pious, you know, bunch in D&D, but he rolls at his own tone, and I think he's kind of a Paylor helps those who help themselves kind of guy. So there, take that. There's your religion check.
And yeah, I think it's incredibly on brand, honestly, that he would have been like, Paylor, I need your help. I'm going to ask you for something, and it would be really great if you answered.
Well, and that's what we call modern courtesy. You text and say, hey, call you in the next 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And then you call.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
So if anything, it was just Paylor being like, all right, I'll pick up when you call.
Yeah. Yeah. Basically that is basically it. And he really would feel like his own self-reliance would be judged by Paylor. Like, it's not that he doesn't think Paylor's not there and he's not doing his part, but I think he thinks that if he doesn't do all he can do first, then he's probably not worthy of any help beyond that. That would be his attitude.
I loved how, by complete accident, when Ben was on, he brought in this element of imposter syndrome or self-doubt to Splendor Belt's religion.
Yeah.
Because every time you'd be like, oh, God of knowledge, thank you so much for this blessed day.
Yeah, it was a real stark contrast. But I don't know. In the end, I think Paylor played it the way, or Paylor, Splendor Belt played it the way he would play it. And you know, he's not looking to be the most, again, pious, you know, dude of the priesthood in the room. He's going to be sort of like, just getting things done sort of guy. And he knows there's a hand in it, but he's not like, you know, begging for it all the time or constantly, you know, throwing praise that way. I think this reflects me. I don't trust people who do that in general. Like, the only people who are super religious that I have a lot of trust and sort of admiration for are the ones who are not up yelling at anyone else or telling anyone else what to do or telling them how great they are. I like people who just quietly go about doing great stuff in their lives, whether it's very quietly helping somebody who has no food or, you know, helping some kids out who need it because they have a rough family life or whatever. Whatever the thing is you're doing it just because it's great to do it and you're not doing it for any kind of show. You don't care who sees it. You'd prefer not to even be noticed. You just go about doing it. That, to me, is somebody who's truly living up to their religious standards. And, that means, you know, drop the pretense, drop the show, just be, you know, be who you are and try to do good. And that's enough, you know, like that. I don't know. That's sort of my attitude in life. And I think if there's any part of me that's in him, I think that's maybe the biggest part. That, and I do like a good potato, but other than that, it's mostly that.
All right. Next question. Are the Delvers unknowingly, now this is kind of like a past thing. I think it got answered, but if there are any behind the scenes things that can play into this, are the Delvers unknowingly raising the big baddie with bringing his organs together from the urns? And doesn't Ko have the magic spear or lance from his bag of holding?
I wound up with a bunch of magic spears in that bag. That bag was full by the end.
Yeah, the spear of radiant lance, or the lance of radiant lance, didn't end up getting used in any way. So if it had been like really embraced and everyone's like, oh man, this is the best weapon ever, I can't wait to wield this, then maybe that would have gone on to be more important. But that's kind of the nature of how I play D&D. The players put importance on something, it becomes more important. But you're absolutely right. They brought together the organs and the urns. The way to think of it is that they had to do that to go through the official door that was guarded by the architect and designed to enter the Dawnless Dunes. There were many other entrances which were accessible through tunnels and ways monsters would go, and the Khalazar used to travel his spirit about. But by gathering the urns, they proved to the architect they could enter and then actually defeat the big bad guy once and for all.
I just assumed it was the Castlevania 2 approach. You know, you got to put Dracula back together so you can kill him good and proper.
There you go. Yeah.
Very true.
I like that. I mean, that should always be our goal. Everyone's goal should be put Dracula back where he came from.
Dracula, go back.
Go back.
Go back. All right, loving the final episodes, guys. Was the holy censure of potato bashing a reward for Splinterbelt's handling of his many and various interpersonal situations? Or did you have it planned as a fail-safe just in case Scott pocketed the 20,000 gold instead of buying a +1 something with his face on it?
Oh, man. Well, you'd have to tell me. I don't know. I was never going to do that, but was there a fear that I was?
It's true. Like, if you had gone and spent all of your money to, like, just completely outfit yourself with some magical itemry,
yeah,
there would be little reason for me to give you a magic item as your reward.
Yeah.
And I likely would have scrambled to come up with something else.
Right.
However, knowing our time together,
yeah,
I knew you weren't going to go buy +3 maces and spend all your money on that. So the magical sensor became the prize for Splinterbelt cleaning up all of his loose ends.
Yeah.
And in that Minotaur moment, it was a single persuasion roll that even got the Minotaurs on his side.
Ooh.
Oh, I didn't
otherwise they would have said no.
Oh, I didn't realize it was down to that one roll. I remember the roll being really good, but I guess I assumed it was one way or the other, and my persuasion was either going to affect their attitude in a positive or negative way, but they were coming no matter what. That's interesting. No idea. I'm glad they did. I like the Minotaur side stuff, just anything to do with Chad Brad. That's some of my favorite stuff of the entire Delvers run. And I think it all came down to your characterization of them. They're normally kind of, you know, boring and standard, but that Chad Brad he's memorable.
The farm was really fun, yeah, and a cool way to bring in multiple bits. In fact, I was looking through my old notes, and during the final fight with the Roper in season 1, I mentioned, I think it was to Ko, he saw a hag as well as a Kuotoa and a Bullywug watching the fight. That hag was the one that had the tower later on in season 2. And the Bullywug was Muck Muck.
Yeah.
And the Kuotoa was Gleepoma.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone came back to the farm.
But is that an example of, you said earlier, like players determine where you put your importance, you know, as DM, was that a case of like, I mean, the farm probably came out of nowhere for you. Like, you're like, what? Okay, I guess we're doing a farm. But it became a pinnacle of story and had its own full side story with multiple characters and other stuff. That fascinated me because when I was first like, you know, want to grow potatoes and want to do it on a farm, I just thought you'd say, oh boy, here we go. We're going to do some, you know, some weird jumping around on that, but it's going to be real minor. But instead, you made it like a real backdrop.
Yeah, it was really fun to do that. And it tied into the corruption of the land that was going on with the Noble Hollow and you kind of being on the edge of it. And eventually it all worked out that Splendorbelt was invested in saving the city, saving his farm, and saving his employees even from this evil. Mm-hmm. And there's very much a world where, and it happens a lot in like cartoons in particular, where everyone's a bit more, let's all hold hands for friendship, because only one person's on the main quest.
I see.
And that could have very easily been Ko. And just everyone's like, yeah, this is what there is to do.
Right. Well, hopefully it wasn't too much for the other two where you guys are like, holy shit, I've had it with this farm.
Wait, no, I love the farm. Yeah. I would say the only disappointment, but then it turned into something that I thought was endearing, was I was like, oh man, Scott's going to rebuild this thing. And I thought we were going to go a route of like creating our own base there, because Kyle gave you so many like, you can build this. I was like, oh, are we gonna build like a base of operations and fortify it? And like, I was wondering, like, is the finale gonna be like a big assault on Splendorbelt's farm, and you know, you got to be fortified for it? And then you're like, no, I'm still sleeping in the ruined tower, no roof over my head. And I was like, I don't think we're gonna do that.
Gonna,
or if Kyle really adheres to it, like, we're in trouble.
Yeah, like that whole thing, I wondered how you were gonna handle that, because you know, I was in no hurry to have any big hours of the show spent on us, you know, rebuilding a farm so much. But, and also, you know, one thing we didn't do, we had a whole chunk of time pass between seasons. And I guess that was me, but I opted not to have any of that work done. You know what I mean? Like, it was still just sort of a bombed out looking shelter or whatever. By the time we finished, I suppose I could have, like, you know, I could have colluded with Kyle and said, all right, well, over that 6 months or that 3 months, whatever it was, I would have built a, you know, a proper shack home out there for one. And, you know, we would have converted some of this into like employees quarters or something. We could have gone crazy with it, but you know, he also had work to do. In fact, what I prefer instead is that the character is overworked, and that meant that the priority, as much as he loved doing stuff at the farm, the priority was always, well, we got to go out and do this mission. And so that put him in a place where he was negligent with his employees. And that became part of the thing, because, you know, I didn't have time to focus in there. At least, you know, Splendorbelt didn't. So I don't know. I thought that was really organic and turned out to be a fun arc for the character, where he got, you know, kind of overwhelmed with guilt at one point because he realized he had been leaving those guys, you know, left hanging out to dry, I guess.
There was kind of a sacrificial side to it, though, that I think played well into the environment of the cleric, because you did supply the city during its time of rapid inflation and invasion from these like kingdom corporations to run the dungeon stuff. You supplied the town with cheap potatoes that you didn't price gouge. So in one, you know, very short scene, we talked about how there was a huge line of people, including guildmates, who were lined up to eat and purchase Splendorbelt potatoes because they couldn't afford anything else.
Yeah.
And so it ended up being, you know, it ended up being a force for good. But John's right. Like, much like the players enhanced the thing, if you guys had gone full, let's fortify the farm and main base it, there's absolutely a world when then that could have become a big thing. In fact, at one point, I even sent a mummy, a deathlock by stats, to fight Scott on his farm. And it was defeated and taken strictly to the guild. And it wasn't really questioned that the farm was in any sort of danger.
Oh, yeah.
But I did forcibly build a barn, because there's no way to, for lack of a better word, hatch the potatoes to get them sprouting without putting them in the dark. So we needed, at the very least, to make the farm make sense, we needed that barn.
Yeah, that makes sense. Wow. Yeah, it's a fun, I'm going to miss that part of it as we move to go back to the waste for a while. I'm going to miss that aspect of it. But there's always Nash's inventory where he keeps all kinds of weird shit, so it'll be fine.
Nash's farm.
Yeah, his little pocket farm.
It's in his pants. Yep.
Why is Ko's daughter immune to the drone? She is a type of half-elf?
Because it's a little dark.
Mm.
is ultimately what it comes down to. I did, you know, I did add a twinge of threat there towards the end, where she started experiencing some of the dreams that Anathela was having throughout her life.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, time in Atemur there. which eventually led to her comatose and kind of mind control business by the Khalasar. But she was basically off limits. There were many opportunities along the way for me to kidnap her, up the ante. And there was definitely a world where in an environment story where Ko wasn't so single-minded to save his wife, that his wife would have been taken down to the Khalasar's pyramid. And that would have been a huge part of the climax. But after he was so dedicated to freeing her, to keeping her safe, to being there as much as possible, to giving her even a dagger to protect herself, it would not have been fair, and it would have been extremely cheap of me as DM to say, and I kidnapped her anyway, and your daughter's gone. Ah, I'm so villainous.
Right, yeah. And we even defeated him in that dream. So, like, what would have been the point of the dream defeat?
Right, because if you guys didn't defeat him in the dream, then his power grows and she just gets up in the middle of the night and walks off and wanders into the Underdark on her own. And that is fair because I had won, but I lost and I had to give up that line.
Yeah,
I think that's cool. And, you know, I will say as a player, not that I asked for it. I think it's just the case of Kyle reading his players and the situation and the tone of his story very well. But as somebody who, you know, kind of picked the story arc that he did, because I was, you know, going through, I think, having a baby when we started. Yeah, wasn't even born yet. And then having a little baby and being a new dad and all of that. I think it probably would have given me legitimate anxiety if stuff kept happening to Penny throughout the story. So I'm grateful that Kyle made the decision he made.
All right, got a couple of general questions. The first one, with the Delvers drawing to a close for now and the Wastes on the horizon again, what, if anything, are you doing to prepare to jump back into the old characters? Especially curious for Kyle going from DM back to a player.
Yeah, I'd be curious about your answer about that too, Kyle. Maybe it's nothing. Maybe it's just like, oh, I'll just be playing and no big deal. The transition's easy. But I don't know. Do you feel like you're going to have to go back and go, oh, yeah, this is how to ride this other bike?
It is. The difficulty with jumping back to Varel is more the moment that we left it at, mm-hmm. with the entire elf spaceship exploding and the crash and the sky opened up. And I think Principal City exploded. Like, there's a lot going on in Varel's mind. But to prepare for the character, I don't have to prep in the morning. So I'm going to work out before the show. And I love that. I love lifting heavy things before playing Varel. Before going back to, like, if I'm going to play Varel and I feel kind of like weak and tired, it doesn't work. But I just go lift a bunch of things. I feel really successful. Ah, I'm in character. All set. Ready to go.
Yeah, I mean, what's weird is of all the characters we're going back to, the one I can hear in my head is Varel. Like, that's the one immediately jumps out and says, remember me? Like, I can just hear your voice doing it. So my guess is it'll be a real smooth transition for that character. I'm a little nervous about Nash because it's been a while. I feel rusty, but we'll see. Stanley just asked.
Do you even remember the names of your children?
Oh, shit.
I have kids.
Spoon. There's Spoon, right? Isn't there a Spoon?
I think Fork. I don't think there's a Spoon.
Okay. Nash Jr.
Fork.
Nash Jr.
Pipe.
Pipe.
Yeah.
Yeah, those are the three. No, wait. There's three plus Nash Jr., right? Or no?
Yeah.
Oh, is that right? Four kids? Okay. So we got Nash Jr., Fork, Pipe. What was the other one?
I think Boot.
Boot? Yeah, oh, Boot. That's it. Yeah. Fork, Pipe, and Boot. That's right. Okay, see, I'm good. I'm all set.
Yeah, I don't remember much of what was going on, but I will say this wasn't really done to prepare, but, you know, just the behind-the-scenes thing, you know, I didn't know. We had a meeting to talk about whether or not we were going to go back to the Waste if Bo was ready and all of that, like, a while back. It's been a while. And I hadn't heard anything from Bo since, and we were getting very close to time. And I didn't know if he was actually going to come back, and we had already teased it. And I was like, man, if he ends up saying no or doesn't want to do this and doesn't feel like doing it, and we've been saying we're going back to the Waste, I thought, well, maybe I'll DM it and I'll do the Waste. So I actually started writing a campaign ending to the Waste, and I've been doing it for like a couple weeks. And then I talked to Bo. I heard back from him, and he was like, yeah, I'm excited to be back. And I was like, awesome. but I'm still kind of in that headspace because I was thinking of it so much. So I feel prepared for the world, but because I won't go back and listen to the episodes, I don't know what was going on right at the very end.
Yeah, I don't either. I don't know where we left it, but
that'd everything's
be,
blown up.
That'll be part of the fun, right? Like
it's all gone.
Yeah, it's all, everything's gone. But I, you know, I remember Nash, the planet Nash with his big penis looking testicle thing and, you know, trying to figure out what's going on there. And, you know, like there's a lot of that stuff I have little vague memories of, but it'll be fun to be thrown back in and try to figure out our crap. I'm looking forward to it.
Are there any lessons you've learned as players from the Delvers campaign you'll take into the Wastes and beyond?
I mean, it's hard to say without Bo being here as DM of the Wastes, but I kind of hope that we end up in a more... I really like how it was structured. And I've said this before in other bonus episodes, and I'll reiterate it. I like the way Kyle structured this thing. It was organized in such a way that the starts and stops of where you could jump in, catch up, jump out were much more defined here. And it isn't to say that a big open-ended thing is a bad idea. It's not, but it's just, you know, I hadn't, in fact, this is the first time I've ever played with this kind of structure where it felt like we had some, not walls, but some semblance of here's where it starts and here's where it ends. And then here's where it starts again. And then here's where it ends. And it felt very, whatever the opposite of just disjointed is. And for the listeners, I liked that. But also for me as a player, I just really like that structure. So I kind of hope we do some of that with the Wastes. I don't know how we'll do it or how Bo will do it. But I mean, if it were me, I'd carry that just structurally, I'd carry that forward.
I think for me, playing Co was a little more, it got a little more away from my personality. Still a lot of me in Co, you know, not a ton of role playing there, but started to get into, he's not a, you know, turned up in some places, turned down in other places version of me, which is basically what Stanley is. You know, it's not hard to play Stanley because I just kind of do what I would do, with maybe some tweaks here and there and a couple things, you know, in mind as far as his backstory or, you know, thinking of situations I wasn't in. So I think getting to RP a little more on a character and not just be an amplified version of myself, I think I can now probably bring a little more of that to Stanley comfortably. Because, you know, with it being my first real D&D session making that character, I didn't want to go too far off the beaten path, which was the original idea, but then I was bad at it. And I didn't think the vision I had for Stanley at the beginning would have done very well with the group dynamic that we had. Yeah. So I think ultimately he just kind of wound up being like me, but yeah. Now maybe we can push him a little further away.
Yeah, that's a good point. I'd say that's true about Nash as well. I mean, Varel, what do you hope to
tell us, Varel?
Yeah, I called you Varel. Jeez.
Hey, see, you're prepared. Kyle. You're already prepared.
Ready to go.
Oh Lord.
What Varel hopes the Waste will be like?
Yeah, or what?
What lessons have you learned?
Yeah, what lessons have you learned here, especially as someone who ran this? Like, what lessons do you take to that, back to that campaign?
I think, and as a character, he would realize this as well. Varel has been wanting to complete the quest of the Wastes in such a way that he said yes to the first thing presented. I think Varel will treat the Wastes more like the job board from Delvers. We'll gather up all the options first, put them out on a table, and then look at all of our options. Because so many times we agreed with a bad guy in the Wastes, or someone who became a bad guy, or took an option that ended up kind of lashing back at us. And it was just, yes, yes, okay, yes. Oh, the clowns. Yes, the Society of Clowns. Get me out of Sigil. And doing more investigative work first and then pursuing the mission.
Oh, yeah. Interesting. Yeah, I think I agree with that. Well, I mean, no matter what, I'm totally looking forward to it. Just as a way to return to some of that old stuff. I look forward to the return to whatever Delvers looks like in the future. Like it feels like, this would be a nice distraction to go back to that stuff that we started with.
What about a Grinkeeper to Hope? That's quite the...
So I've learned... So Hope was originally rolled to fill the Road Warrior position. And if you've watched the Road Warrior movies, Mel Gibson's character has a terrible life. It's horribly depressing.
Yeah.
And he's not a happy individual, even though there's some comedy from other characters interspersed into it. And so when the Waste became more than just a Road Warrior thing, and then like everything's dying and everyone's dying, and Hope brings back people hiding from vampires just so they can die, and then the elves die, like... What I've learned is that Hope's character is a bit too heavy for me personally to like playing for an extended period of time. Like that kind of character, I feel, needs to have a very strong beginning and end, because otherwise they just start dragging their feet after a while and they become the wet blanket of the group. So I've learned that coming back to the Wastes as a player, I need to infuse a bit more levity into Hope so that she doesn't become that wet blanket, because it would be so easy for her to just lay down in the sand to be done with it, you know?
I think that's a really strong thing to say, because I think, and I don't know, like, I don't know if anybody else has talked to Bo. I talked to him and was like, hey, you want to chat about anything, let me know. He's like, I'm good. But like, I kind of feel like all of our characters are in that place, because I'm sitting there going, how does Stanley not just start this going, well, I'm done. Everything is awful. Yeah, we failed at everything. I've lost every home I've ever had, and it's all I really wanted. And I'm done. Thanks all. Bye.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think to give a little taste of it, what I've said, because I've given it a lot of thought. And I think what I've settled on is the more dark humor, none of it matters. Literally none of it matters. Yeah. So let's just see it through to the end and see if we're even the ones who can kill the principal, you know? Because Sigil exists. There are literally every variation of us that exists. The ones that are happy, the ones that are sad. Their Tiet Kala survives, the elves survive. It's not the one we're in, but who cares?
Yeah.
We're just going to do it anyway, because we're stubborn or something.
Something. Something like that.
Finally, how do you feel your Delver's campaign characters would deal with life in the Wastes? And for Kyle, which NPC do you think would fare the best in the world of the Wastes? Grinkeeper would not stand for the Wastes. She would be Varel, but like notched up to 20.
Oh, man. I don't even know how to answer that. I think Splendor Belt would do what he could with what he had, but he wouldn't be happy there. Like, potatoes aren't even going to grow there. That place is barren and horrible.
Yeah, I was going to say, how do potatoes grow in the Wastes? That's really the big question.
Yeah, that's the big kicker. How about Ko? How would he react?
I think he'd do well, but I don't think he'd like it. I mean, nobody really likes the idea of the Wastes, right? But I mean, I think his skills, I think, would translate very well to the world of the Wastes. But
yeah.
Beyond that, I mean, he doesn't really have a lot of interests that gel with that world. So I think he would, likewise, he'd be a very unhappy person.
Yeah, I could see that. He wouldn't, like, one would assume his wife's not there. Like, your reasons for you know, Ko's passions would be left behind, probably. And therefore, he'd be super irritated the whole time. I could see that.
Yeah, and I think he'd be, you know, the funny thing is so much got put into Ko as, you know, he's family man. He's going to take care of his family. He's going to take care of his wife. He's going to take care of his daughter. That's all he's out to do. That I didn't really stop to think too much about what he has outside of that. I knew kind of by meeting the other daters and stuff like that Kyle put in, I kind of found this little niche for him where it was like, you know, you've got the George McFly, like he's definitely the outsider of the group getting picked on, but he's around all the bullies because he's got something that they can get from him. And then over the course of this adventure, finding out, oh, I'm actually way better at everything than they are. Mm-hmm. And I'm actually really good at this. And I feel like if you took the family and the nice part of Ko away, I think you would have somebody who's actually really deadly, really dangerous, and not a very good person, because he'd probably lean a bit more on that satyr side and the fae side, which I deliberately toned down for Ko, because I was like, no, he gave all that up to be the family man. And I think when you get into that, you've got a character that's just, you know, like, purely in the moment, like, what's fun right now? If I want to go out and, you know, fight some people, that sounds great, I'll do that. If I want to steal something, sure, why not, I'll take that. And I think that would be an interesting thing to explore, but it makes for a very different character.
As for what NPC, Mr. Goodwine.
Oh.
Yeah.
Except he'd be like Mr. Goodwater.
Oh, here we go.
You come to my spring. You drink from my spring.
Yeah, it seems like the kind of character would find a way to set up his little mob shop no matter where he went.
It's so funny you say that, because I don't think we got into it, and I think I might have changed him. If I had had Kyle's technology and amazing Godfather impression, that is basically who I envisioned as when we did the Path of Glass.
Yeah,
that is basically who I pictured running the giant steamship.
Oh.
Is exactly
nice.
That. Oh, and he'd be perfect for it. It'd yeah. be so good.
Yeah, he's a great character. He terrified me, to be honest. I don't like, you know, protection money, and just that whole mob thing kind of freaks me out, but I ended up loving how it worked out. He was sure a big dick in that dream, though. Whew. He was horrible.
A question about Ko's daughter. What does she look like? Since she is half elf, half satyr, does she have hooves? Very hairy legs?
This is a great question, because I didn't ever think of it until I read this question. I went, oh, yeah, because originally, and I obviously this got retconned a little bit, and it was partially my mix up, because when I was coming up with Ko, I came up with him a couple times and made changes here and there. But Ko was originally going to be half elf and half satyr. And it's why he had, like, pointy ears and stuff like that. And it was a whole thing that kind of existed and got dropped. But Penny existed off of that original idea, so I just kind of pictured her as, like, this little, like, half-elf-looking child that maybe had a wild, like, mane of hair. But, you know, with that not being the case, it is true. She probably is a lot more satyr than what I was actually picturing. And I think it'd be adorable if she had little hooves. So I'm going to say she's got little hooves.
Nice. I like it. It was one. It's funny because we never did get to see her. We just knew she existed. She was like Norm's wife on Cheers. You never get to see her. That's an old reference. Ask your parents, I guess.
What do you think you'll miss the most about the Delvers campaign, and what are you most looking forward to getting back to the Wastes?
I don't know. John, you have a good answer for that?
Yeah, I do, I think. I'm definitely going to miss, you know, we talked about it a little bit, like the structure and expectation. Like, there's something nice about knowing, you know, what's coming to some degree. You know, you don't go into a dungeon. This is going to sound like I'm throwing shade at Bo. I'm not, because we're going to give Bo a lot of love at the end of this answer. But, like, when we went into a dungeon with Bo, it's like, is this going to be 2 weeks? Mm-hmm. Is this going to be the next year of our lives? Like, what is this dungeon going to look like? I have no idea. I have no idea how long we're going to be in here. What it's going to be, when are we getting out, what we're going to experience, how many times are we going to go through it, how many times it's going to change. Like, there's so much uncertainty. Same with leveling up. You know, we used to make jokes about, because one day was so many episodes, Bo was like, oh, geez, they probably should have leveled by now. And he gave us a level, and we did the math, and we were like, wait a minute, we just leveled twice in one day. And so there was a lot of stuff that was just kind of up in the air because of the very, like, improv, unstructured nature of the Waste campaign. And I think having that expectation of, like, you know, this adventure is going to be about, it's going to be about a day to take care of this. Maybe 2 weeks. you know, of doing this. And knowing that, okay, this is what the XP gains are. And I actually, I thought I was going to hate doing XP leveling, and I ended up loving it. Mm-hmm. So that is what I'm going to miss for sure with the Delvers campaign. The thing I'm looking most forward to getting back into the Waste is, you know, Bo's extremely creative and extremely out there, and he's very, very hard to predict. And he has a really strong knack for kind of capturing your imagination. Yeah. And I've said this before, like, Stanley lives inside me. And I said earlier it's because he is me, but, like, that he seems like a real person to me because I've spent so much time in his head and having to think about how does he interpret this event? What does he think of this? What about this? That he's kind of become alive in a way that Ko was more like, I picked my character before I got into a video game. Yeah. Like, you know, he's cool. He's an awesome character. I like him. But, you know, he's kind of he's a bit of a template. And I think there's just something about Bo's, like, the way he handles things that kind of gets under my skin a little bit. And kind of lives in my brain. And I'm really looking forward to that element of it, because that's definitely something that I feel like he's so good at with what he does.
Yeah, I agree. I wouldn't have much to add to that, except there is a chaos to it that I'm looking forward to messing around with again. Kyle, how about you?
It's incredibly hard to metagame him. And with the structure we had for Delvers, if you thought about it too much, it's very easy to be like, okay, so Kyle's the kind of guy that's not going to give us two fights in a row today. Plus, we know we want to meet this schedule and this sort of show business. So I can use my bigger powers now, and I won't be afraid of not getting that short rest or long rest that I might need. So as a longtime D&D player, it is extremely stressful and fun to play in Bo's world because you can't metagame him.
Yeah.
You can't predict what he's up to. And you also get a lot of custom monsters. Like some of the hardest fights for me as Varel have been when I know full well what that is over there. And I know because I played it, it's weak to this and it's strong against this. And I'm having to fake it the whole time. And do things that are unoptimized in my own head. I'm going, no, I know I should grab a torch and hit it with that because it's weak to fire, but I'm not going to do that because that'd be inside knowledge. And so many times we just fight an angel robot man and you have no idea on paper what that is over there.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. That, you know what? Now that you've said it that way, that's kind of what I'm looking forward to is that, you know, you would do a hook horn. We'd all go, oh yeah, hook horns. We know what that is.
And then right, or the construct where I'm like, well, I'm going to hit him with a psychic dagger. I'm pretty sure this isn't going to work. And Kyle totally got me on that when he's like, how do you finish it? And I'm like, oh, man, it worked. Cool. Yeah. I do this. This is what I do. And he's like, yeah, that would have been awesome, but you didn't do it at all. And I was like, oh, my gosh.
That was a pretty good moment. I enjoyed that.
Next question for Kyle. Did Grinkeeper circumvent a big boss battle by cutting the hoses connected to the large statue being built in the hall? Also, what was your reaction behind the DM screen to Ko's spider climb awesomeness? Were you surprised by how effective it was?
That was really awesome. I mean, we hid. Ko had his Spider-Man bag of clothes he would change into. Like, there was a lot of Spider-Man-isms to Ko that I played into. I knew it would fascinate John and he'd have a lot of fun with it. But the spider climbing thing was completely made up on the spot. We had Dharma Edgestream there, who's a wizard who I mained the character sheet for. And yeah, she had spider climb. So it ended up working out. And that was really cool. So the big boss battle and the cutting hoses, yes, that would have been an iron golem. And an iron golem is a level 15 encounter.
Oh geez.
So the reason why you guys fought the double golems in the split puzzle dungeon with Ben was because I had to introduce the idea that golems were immune to psychic attacks to Ko, so that if they went the route that they fought the iron golem, the giant statue of the Khalazar, it wouldn't be a surprise in the final battle, because that'd be cheap. So we had to introduce that counter early on. Plus, there was like the Bahir dungeon where there was the golem that had been split open and the Bahir was running around in there. And there's that kind of part of your brain that goes, oh, man, with a stone golem. I wonder if that's hard to fight. How cool. And you kind of want to see what a stone golem fight would be like. And so we got to actually enjoy that.
Yeah.
But the entire the Khalazar statue was a different climax in a number of ways. So one thing that could have happened completely is the Delvers just fart off. Like season three happens. They're loving doing all these little dungeons. They're not really tied to the main quest. Cassius disappeared and they're like, whatever, it's fine. We're just going to go adventure. We want to get rich. Splendorbelt wants money. Co wants money. Grinkeeper's just feeding evil. And nobody goes down there.
Yeah.
So there's a world where time elapses so far. All the elves have been missing for over 3 months and they complete the statue and it comes above ground and starts destroying the town.
Oh, geez.
And the other thing that could have happened, which was very real and very likely in some ways, was that you all from the top of the dune said, all right, we've got 10 minotaurs. We've got multiple silver leagues. Charge. And you all charge down that hill. And in that way, the guards with their psychic spears would have met you first. And inside the Khalazar would have been taken from his bed, inserted into his sarcophagus. And that would have been plugged into the back of the golem. And then the golem would have marched out. And I have the button ready here.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
That's pretty good.
And it would have been marching. And it would have done a...
Yeah.
As it came out. And then it would have been...
Cool.
It would have been eye lasers and big slammy weapons. And he would have been decimating, you know, basically taking this huge force that you all invaded with and very much working to cut it down in size. Because you charged.
Right.
And because that's the climax you chose. Now, on the back end of that, the boss goes down. The Khalazar's body's there. You still kind of do the other fight on the other side. But Ko's spider climb business and stealth circumvented that entire thing, which was absolutely available to him. And that's why the robot did nothing.
Okay.
The giant iron golem did nothing because that was the path you all chose. And you all embraced Ko being a part of that and let him have that stealth time as part of our show. So we skipped it.
Love it.
Yeah, now everybody's going to be mad at me, though, because I made the robot not happen.
What? No, dude, you're stealthing so good, man. Like, I was relieved because I was so worried that if we didn't take the guards out, they would have hurt the innocent people, the mind-controlled people. So, like, oh, that whole scene, I was on edge.
Yeah, that's what I thought, too. You know, instead we got Die Hard, and I thought Die Hard was pretty good.
Die Hard was good.
That's good.
Yeah. Everyone likes Die Hard. Who doesn't like Die Hard?
I still want to see drawings of the Delvers. All right, what would have happened if Splendorbelt had lost his death-saving roles? What would have happened to the farm, to his employees, and would Paylor have brought him back for his heroism?
Ooh, that's a great question. I mean, Kyle would have to answer a lot of that, but I didn't have a will. So it would be a regret that I didn't tell Gleepoma or whoever that, hey, if I'm killed in one of these, and I probably should have thought of that because we were always doing stuff that could kill me. I probably should have said, look, this is all yours if I die. Because that's what I probably would have done, is just given it to those guys and let them run it. Definitely not giving it to Mob Guy. He'll take his hunk no matter what. But yeah, I would have done that. But had I died, I don't know. Kyle, what would you have done?
Well, if you would have died, but everyone else
had a resurrection,
right?
Revivify. So she would have brought you back, definitely.
So I would have had to kill everybody for Splendorbelt to die for good,
right?
And that storyline is kind of interesting because there was a very real reality where you guys would have, you know, kaput down there. The Khalazar was hitting hard, and it was rather tense towards the end. If you had completely failed, what would have happened was the Khalazar would have completed his giant robot, which, of course, like just like I never said pyramid until we got to the pyramid. I never said mummy for as long as possible. I would have never said giant robot there because that's cheesy.
Yeah.
However, when I say a statue's marching up and the music's playing, like, you're like, ah, yeah, it's kind of a giant robot. Yeah, I got plugged in the back. It's basically like an Ava unit. It's a Gundam. Yep. Yeah. But as long as you don't say those things, it can remain its own thing. So he would have completed his statue. He would have mind controlled the Delvers, now as his evil lieutenants.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no.
And they would have all gone up above. And much like Kosa in that vision, they would have built flying pyramids, and the Kalazar's kingdom would have reigned above ground and eventually likely allied with the vampire nation. And
no.
And then they'd
mummies
be,
and vampires.
Yeah.
No.
Working together.
Eventually becoming mummy vampires.
This is the universal dark universe. I saw this.
Yeah.
Well, it's inevitable.
It got canceled.
Yeah. But, you know. you thought you might see more of it, but no, it's done. Out.
So the world would have been on its way to end is basically the answer there. Oh, wow. But if Slenderbelt had gone down and Grinkeeper had gone down, there is a world where Paylor would bring him back for his service, likely as a guardian or a spirit of some kind that protects the farm rather than a full-blown hero.
Yeah.
You know, it's weird. That would cheapen the world.
Sure. What's weird is... what was I going to say? It would have been more strange to me had I died, because we have so many, we have a pretty deep health pool in terms of healing and spells and revivals and like bringing back to one hit point. And, you know, we had a lot of stuff in our arsenal, so it would have gotten worse if I had to die, but I had a very little chance of doing that, given that, you know, in particular, Grinkeeper had all kinds of stuff to help me. And we would have survived that probably no matter what. But if I'd have been a ranger or some other, you know, we were less health focused in our builds, probably would have been a little more dire that day.
The next question: what Final Fantasy 14 / WoW job would all of your characters play?
Is this signed by Jonger, like a somebody that sounds like John's name, but not quite.
No,
not John Jagger 21.
Yeah,
that's him.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah, not John Jagger.
No,
that's how you know it's not me. One's real easy for Ko. Yeah. In fact, it actually kind of fits the Final Fantasy path, because in that you Rogue is not one of the initial classes you can even pick. You have to get to level 10 before you can even do it. So he probably would have been a scholar, then turn that into a rogue at level 10, and then at level 30 or whenever it happens, and you get your new job, he'd be a ninja. So he would be a ninja right now.
Nice. Just like John. Well, no, you did just ninja like for a while, and then you went back, right?
Yeah, I'm a dancer now.
Yeah. Did you have to go tell your Final Fantasy father that you've decided to give up on a lifelong dream of ninja and now you just want to be a dancer? And then
I want to dance.
What's
father?
To dance, father? I don't know enough about the game to say. I liked the Dragoon a lot when I did play. I know that was just a starting job to lead to other things, but I really liked it. So maybe that. I guess that's the only experience I really have is that Dragoon.
You can pick a WoW class. They said / WoW.
Oh, they did,
gave you.
They?
They gave you an out.
That's fair. I lean... That's a great question. Major Hunter. That's the way I'd go. Caster or shooting shit from far away. Actually, either way, I'm shooting shit from far away. How about you, Kristen?
It looks like there are paladins at level 1 in the job guide. So,
oh yeah, you just be right there then.
True, be a paladin regardless, Final Fantasy or WoW.
Yeah, Kyle, I know you DM'd, but what would you do?
Oh God.
Varel would definitely be a warrior, and then I guess a warrior in both, since there's not really a barbarian. He ain't got those magics, you know. No. He's just out there.
Yeah, well, either way, you'd have to have like massive bonus to persuasion, because I've seen what you've done to Garrett, and I don't know how you did it. So you'd have to have like plus 20 to persuasion, so every roll was at least 20 or higher or something, because that seemed impossible what you did. I don't know.
Well, how perhaps you did as it. A gamer, I'm a bard then,
maybe
whispering in the ears. Yeah. Come play this game.
Come play with us.
You want to play this game? You
guys are killing me.
I have a question for Scott. Scott.
Yeah.
Seriously, why potatoes?
Who wrote that? What's the name?
Jeppers 2.
Jeppers 2. I want to know more about that name, Jeppers, but for now I'll answer it thusly. I think I kind of answered this before. And maybe I wasn't being serious about it, and so now he's saying, seriously, why potatoes? It was originally kind of like a humble idea. It was this humbling kind of like, oh, you know, follower of Paylor. He's not super flamboyant about his belief, classes, or abilities. He just wants to sort of, you know, I don't know. He's just kind of a bare bones kind of dude. And what is the most bare bones thing you can think of that you could grow and feed people with? And to me, it's always potatoes for whatever reason. It's like some kind of starch because you can spread it wide. You know, you can use it. You can get more out of it per person than you could, you know, lettuce or something. And often, you know, when populations are in a situation of famine or otherwise, potatoes are often what saves them. So to me, that was like his, you know, he's just focused on what's a basic staple. What's a thing that will get people by? At the very least, it gets them by. And then you can grow from there. You can make all kinds of fancy stuff with potatoes as well. But starting at a very low level, the most common person in the city could subsist on a potato. And that appealed to him. And me, I guess. I don't know if that helps Jeppers. I hope it does.
I think it's a good answer. Yeah. And then we've got one final thing, because I remember this coming up maybe a month ago, 2 months ago or something, but it was requested that Kyle gives us a tour of his voices, both with and without the voice changer.
Oh geez. Okay.
Is cool. Let's do it.
Probably Chad Brad's the most ridiculous, because I'm literally sitting there going, ooh.
We're good here. It's the voice changer that makes that work. It's hard to explain.
I turn it off and I'm just going like this. And I'm just sitting here talking like this, trying not to laugh the whole time.
That's revealing to hear that without it. That's weird. Very weird. Now I question everything.
We've done Mr. Goodwine, and certainly that's been
without the voice changer. You know, you gotta put it in the back of your throat, and then you just turn it off, and you're basically sitting here, kind of talking like this to yourself, like some magic. And then of course, as they laugh more, I'd start really elongating the words, and then Marvin would show up.
I need to say, while we're doing this, just because I just thought of this, Kyle has permanently ruined people saying that somebody is their friend for me, which is something that people say a lot. But whenever I hear somebody say, "Oh yeah, they're a good friend of mine," like as soon as anybody acknowledges a friend, I just have Kyle in the back of my head going, "Cause you're such a good friend. You're my very good friend. Just my best friend." And it just plays nonstop. Anytime anybody uses the word friend around me, he has permanently etched himself upon that word with Mr. Goodwine.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to avoid.
That one's actually kind of interesting because it actually increases my volume. So when I made the Goodwine voice with the voice changer, I had to do a little bit of whisper, and because otherwise it gets too loud and too peaky.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a result of that. I mean, a lot of it is me just. This would be.
Yes, this was the evil. The evil when it come around. So you had like. Rutharamod, and you're sitting here, and you're just doing a lot of elongating and making sure everything is very tasty. And when the voice changer picks that up, that's a sort of elegance to it.
Oh, what about the poofs?
Oh, yeah, let's hear the poofs.
Okay, yeah, here we go. This was like, hi.
I'm Toot. And when you really, and you can play with it when you go really high, because that would give it.
Welcome to the deep.
Wind springs. I'm poop.
and the more you'd like, woo.
It's funny. So it's really, it was the flump, right?
Yeah, the flumps, okay. The little fart creatures.
Funny side note, the flump that I drew that day, that episode where you introduced that voice, is the most feedback I've gotten on any of the pieces that we did for season 3. Like, people really, really glommed onto the flump. Like, people were like, my kid's favorite character from D&D is then. We want, is there t-shirts? Is there dirt? And I'm like, well, not really, but maybe we could, you know, like that kind of stuff. It was crazy. The flump was a big hit.
What else? The only other thing I think I have still programmed right now from season 3 was the old rat who was just screaming. And that was just me sitting here going like this. No.
Yeah.
No.
That's great. Very cool. Nice look into the Foley world of Kyle Ferguson. Nice job. And those are your questions, everybody. Well done. Man, great ones this time. And we'll do it again at the very end of this month or very start of December, depending on how things go. But we do them monthly, and it's because you guys support us at therewillbedungeons.com. Please keep that up, because if you do, well, I will keep doing it. I think that's everything. As far as schedule goes, we start back with Waste next week, is it?
Yeah, next week.
Okay, so next Saturday, 2 p.m. Mountain Time, we do a live stream, frogpants.tv, if you want to be there. That's when we do our show most normal weeks anyway. But starting back up on the Waste with Bo in the hot seat, and that'll be next week. So you're going to want to be there for that. If you'd rather just get the podcast version, you know how to get it. You're listening to it already. All the details for any of this is at therewillbedungeons.com. That'll do it for us, for me, for John, for Kristen, and for Kyle. We'll see you next time.